This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in this week for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll be talking about what's gone wrong with Kickstarter, the company that raises funds for creative projects through online crowdsourcing.
Our guest says Kickstarter is meant to fund interesting creative projects, but it's been corrupted by celebrities using it for their personal cash cow.
But first, we're talking about the role that race has played in the George Zimmerman trial. Zimmerman is charged with shooting 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. The prosecution says the shooting was a racially charged homicide. The defense says the case is about self-defense by a concerned Neighborhood Watch volunteer.
Over the past 3 weeks, people following the trial have been talking about race, from the racial makeup of the jury to the code switching of a key witness.
And here to help break down this issue for us is Eugene Kane, contributor to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Eugene, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you along. I want to start out with just sort of your general impressions of this trial. You know, you've been around for a while. You've seen a lot of trials. And on the one hand, this one seems like a pretty simple question of murder. On the other hand, there's nothing simple about this trial at all.
Well, yeah, I have to admit my reaction from watching it on TV for the past couple weeks. It's been kind of frustrating because of my viewpoint that Trayvon Martin, the narrative has not changed from Trayvon Martin being basically an innocent young black teen who was trying to get home, who was being followed by pretty much a vigilante community watch person, and they had a confrontation, and after the confrontation, Trayvon is dead. I just don't feel the trial has been focusing as much on those basic facts as it has been dealing with a lot of other issues that I don't really, that I don't think are as relevant to the case. So it's been very frustrating. I do see the racial elements of it, but I don't really think race is the biggest thing if you just look at what the facts are. And a lot, and myself and a lot of other people are just concerned at how things are progressing. I'll say that.
So race is not the biggest thing, and the biggest thing is that this murder is getting lost in all of that?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is that because, well, race is certainly part of this, the racial profiling that I think the trial evidence has shown took place, if only because the accused George Zimmerman is a guy who was known to call in suspicious black males, and that's all he called in. That night, there was a encounter that nobody really saw, but now all the focus on is on whose screams were heard on a 911 tape and who was on top and who wasn't on top. When the basics are that there were two people, one was armed, one wasn't armed. Trayvon Martin had made phone calls to a friend expressing his concern about being followed. So to me, if you take the gun away, it's an encounter between two guys who basically, if it just seems to me that if Trayvon Martin really did defend himself and there was a scuffle, without the fact that George Zimmerman was armed, he'd still be alive today.
Now, you've been pretty active tweeting in the I don't know what to call it, the tweetiverse or what we call that world where
Twitterverse,
tweets are,
I think.
Twitterverse, there we go. You tweeted that this trial reflects the extreme fear that some white Americans have about angry black males. And could you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, I think most of the reaction I get are from African-Americans, but not exclusively African-Americans, but many of them mothers who, or parents who see themselves as possible parents of a Trayvon Martin who goes out one night. And we just have to hammer home on the point that Trayvon Martin was an innocent. He was not a criminal. He was not a thug doing something wrong. George Zimmerman did not encounter him or confront him to keep him from breaking the law or anything. So my sense is that I just really do feel the way the trial has been going, it's just been very disconcerting to a lot of people that I know. I'm not sure if I answered your question.
No, you're getting to it. And I want to talk a little, sort of continue on in another column that you wrote a week or so ago. You talked a lot about the testimony of Trayvon Martin's friend, Rachel Jantel. And she was a witness, of course, for the prosecution, but her testimony was sort of confused sometimes. And, you know, sometimes it almost seemed confrontational. And I'm wondering how you think this may have impacted things.
Well, yeah, getting to the point where what this trial is showing is that a large amount of I don't know the exact number, but many Americans, many white Americans, seem to feel because Trayvon was basically very aggressive that night, somehow this armed community watch person had the right to shoot and kill him when he felt his life was being threatened. And I just think that's the very racial element to me, because I wonder if Trayvon Martin wasn't a young black male, and if there are a lot of white people weren't convinced that, well, if I ever encountered a black young black male who seemed that he wanted to, you know, attack me, I would feel justified in shooting him too. And that's just so wrong-headed. It gets away from what the basic facts of this trial are. So that's why I do think the stand your ground rules in Florida, which aren't really in effect on this Zimmerman trial, but still, the sense that you can use self-defense, particularly if you're so freaked out by a young black male, I just that's my reading on how it possibly has gotten to the point where every day Trayvon Martin is essentially on trial more than George Zimmerman is.
But that is also always the job of the defense, isn't it? To try to muddy the waters, to try to shed that doubt, to plant that seed.
Which is why I and others are so kind of agitated, angry, just annoyed with the way the prosecutors in Florida are handling this case. I mean, they have let it. They have let Zimmerman basically present his case and focusing on things like the scuffle and who's on the tape yelling. And to me, they've gotten away from the whole idea that, again, this is an innocent young black man who did nothing wrong, who was confronted by the person who was following him. There was a scuffle, which you could almost say, if you put yourself in the head of Trayvon, who is a minor, he's 17 years old. He's being followed by an adult with a gun. How it gets to the point where now everybody's questioning whether Trayvon Martin did something so wrong that he deserved to die that night. It's confusing me. It's confusing a lot of my friends, some many of whom are African-American, many who are not. That's where I'm seeing it now. As you can tell, I'm in a very agitated state about this Zimmerman trial at this point.
Well, I tell you, I don't think you're alone. We heard a few minutes ago news at the top of the hour that George Zimmerman is choosing not to testify in his trial.
I predicted that.
Oh, you did? And tell me why.
Well, because, I mean, he really doesn't have to now. And if he and on cross-examination, more would be brought out. Even the latest testimony of the struggle and who was on top and why and whether or not Trayvon Martin was actually pulling away when Zimmerman shot him and killed him. I mean, I do understand why, from his point of view, Zimmerman, you know, he could hurt himself by testifying. I wish he would, but clearly they've decided not to do that.
We're going to wrap up here in a second, but before we do, one quick question. Does this trial have some legs in terms of its influence on and having a discussion on lending some clarity to these difficult subjects of race and crime and all of that? Are we going to see anything beyond the headlines come out of this?
Well, I think what will actually happen, particularly in Florida, is it'll be seen if, like I predict, that Zimmerman might be acquitted if he's not, if the jury isn't given the opportunity to perhaps convict him on a lesser charge of manslaughter, which I think now might have been the best way to charge him anyway. I do think the long-term effects will be that a lot of the citizens who fear young black males will somehow feel more justified in using deadly force to protect themselves after the fact. And I fear for that. I think that would be a terrible thing to happen.
Well, Eugene, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Oh, thank you for asking me.
That was Eugene Kane, contributor to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
Coming up, we'll talk to a reporter from the Atlantic Wire about why he says Kickstarter has been corrupted by celebrities. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. When all they've got is a personal credit card, Kickstarter has been a boon when it comes to funding meaningful personal projects for artists without name recognition or access to big-ticket donors.
But our next guest says the waters are getting muddy now that celebrities are using the platform to fund their personal projects. Artist and Kickstarter favorite Amanda Palmer, who recently made headlines for raising $1.2 million for her latest album, recently told us why fans who contribute to her work get something back.
I don't look at all at that act as them giving their money away. It doesn't feel at all like charity. It always feels like a very exciting two-way exchange where they pay me $5 and they get an album in return. And they get to feel like they have helped me do it, which they have. So it's, you know, in the crowdfunding sort of, you know, controversy that seems to be all over the place right now, especially with Zach Braff and right. Veronica Mars and all of these filmmakers getting a lot of flack and, you know, big musicians getting flack for using crowdfunding. I think a lot of people are just missing the fundamental point, which is that crowdfunding has nothing to do with charity.
Musician Amanda Palmer defending her phenomenal success using Kickstarter to connect with her fans and fund her art.
Richard Lawson isn't so sure about Kickstarter when used by celebrities. He's a senior writer at the Atlantic Wire and takes issue with the celeb phenomenon. Richard, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Richard, what went through your mind as you're listening to Amanda Palmer talk there about her success using Kickstarter?
Well, I mean, I think that she's a kind of special case, but I did find it kind of funny when she says, you know, that doesn't feel like charity. And, you know, I think probably to her it doesn't, but I think from kind of the outside looking in, it does seem like people are sending money sort of with no kind of accountability for how it's spent and just because someone asked for it. And so, yeah, it chafed a little, I guess.
Well, you've ruffled some feathers. First, when you wrote a piece about the Veronica Mars movie project. Now, this was a TV show. They wanted to turn it into a movie, and they turned mm-hmm. to Kickstarter. And Zach Braff also wanted to fund his next indie movie project. And both of those got under your skin a little. Can you tell us about why?
Yeah, I mean, there was something to me that seemed a little, I guess the word I used at the time was unseemly, about these wealthy, you know, established Hollywood people just kind of asking money for a product that has not been made, that we've not seen anything from. I suppose in the Veronica Mars case, we had the example of the show, obviously, to go on. But even then, you know, it's been a number of years since the show is on the air. We have no idea what this movie is going to look like. And the same thing for the Zach Braff project, whereas, you know, he obviously has fans from Garden State and other things. But you know, they're asking for upwards of $10,000 for something that no one's seen yet when they are all well-paid, you know, TV and film stars.
Isn't it true of all Kickstarter projects, though, that you don't know what the end product is going to be? You don't know if you're going to contribute to something successful and your money will be well spent, or whether you're essentially just throwing it away. That's the nature of it.
No, it is. It's true. I mean, it's kind of a tricky thing. I think it's sort of a case-by-case basis. I mean, someone, you know, who wants to have funding for a month so they can go write, you know, a book that's their passion project, you know, depending on the circumstances, obviously, I think it's a great medium to raise funds for that. But when you do have this sort of looming kind of in the background specter of something like big studio Hollywood, I mean, you know, Warner Brothers is involved in the Veronica Mars movie, and Zach Braff recently got, you know, $10 million in funding for his movie when he was in Cannes. So I think that, you know, we have to look at what's behind it. If it really is just a private entity or a group of people just really wanting to make something and not having the money to do it, that's one thing. But when people are, you know, sending hard-earned money towards something where a huge, you know, companies are really rich, you know, concerns are going to profit, and they'll get is the movie that they just paid $100 to see. It sort of raises some questions for me.
We had a comment here. Holly on Facebook wrote about this, and she said, I actually donated to this project, and by that she's talking about Zach Braff's project.
Sure.
One of my all-time favorite films is Garden State, which was created largely in part by a private donation which allowed for a true depiction of the story by the artist. To ensure the opportunity to see another unpolluted film by Zach, I didn't hesitate to donate. So there's one person's take on why she did donate to that project. Do you think most people are thinking like Holly?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, when I wrote the initial post about the Veronica Mars Kickstarter, I got probably, I don't know, 12 hours worth of, you know, very vociferous feedback on Twitter and on the comments on the post. You know, people really do feel passionate about this. And I don't, you know, I don't think that they're being duped necessarily or anything like that. But, you know, I think in the case of the Zach Braff movie, like your commenter said, I kind of don't really necessarily believe the narrative that Zach Braff, who had such huge success with Garden State and is now, you know, he had a season's worth of television show, I don't really believe the narrative that there would be all this manipulation and meddling, especially when after the funds were raised on the Kickstarter, he went and got, you know, private funding upwards of $10 million. You know, so I think he probably had the independence to do it. To me, it read more as a kind of, honestly, like a kind of a PR move to do the Kickstarter campaign.
Sort of like a vanity project then?
Yes, and a way to sort of make it seem kind of cool and hip and you know, of the moment, I guess.
Do you think any of the onus should be on Kickstarter itself here, that they should maybe put a cap on who's allowed to use it? Because idealistically, it should be for the little guy, I guess. And when we're seeing celebrities like Zach Braff, Veronica Mars, is there a problem with the way it's being used?
Well, I think that once you start to get into, you know, Kickstarter itself policing any of that, I think, you know, it gets territory, gets murky. How do you make those distinctions? I think that one big thing that Kickstarter could try to do, I don't know how they'd enforce it necessarily, but is it the matter of accountability. I mean, you know, and that's true of all Kickstarter projects, not just these big, you know, celebrity ones. In terms of, you know, we could hear in 6 months that the Veronica Mars movie is the production's been shut down. Same with the Braff, you know, and then there's no sort of recourse for anyone who's donated. And on the other side of that, you know, there's no accountability in terms of how the money is spent. And I think that that's, I know where Amanda Palmer had kind of run into some trouble when people found out that after raising $1 million, she was still asking local musicians to play her shows for free. You know, so I think that if possible, Kickstarter could sort of set up rules for the how the money is going to be spent and allocated and things like that.
So earlier you said Amanda Palmer was a special case. She's a well-known, in her own circles, musician. She's been in the New York Times for her success with Kickstarter. Why is she a special case?
Well, I think it was earlier in Kickstarter's life when she was involved in it. And I think that she kind of, you know, skirts that line between, you know, she was on a major label and arguably that's their kind of machine is what really put her. And I guess it was when she was in Strauss and Dolls, sort of put her into the national spotlight. And she owes a lot to that. But, you know, she has obviously gone a more kind of independent route since then. I think, you know, I know where people take issue with her is that she sort of, she gave a TED talk about asking for things, and you know, she has a story about a family sleeping in their living room so she and her band could use the bed, and you know, she's just saying that it's an exchange, like she said in that clip. And I think that she kind of does ignore also that, like, someone of her status sort of was already at a certain level where she could ask and get anything in return. You know, I think that I think it's a great system for people like her who, you know, have a certain level of notoriety, but I don't think that I don't think that we can universally apply, you know, kind of her crowdfunding philosophy.
Well, even that notion of asking for things, mm-hmm. when someone is a little bit famous and they have that sparkly aura of money and fame about them, I think people are more inclined to give. Maybe there's a certain mm-hmm. compulsion to it, even though you might not be aware of it.
Yes, I know. I think there definitely is. I mean, I think that I know that there are people who use Kickstarter almost like, you know, just the website you go to every day to read, and they kind of scour and they find projects that they like and they fund them. And I think that's great. But yeah, obviously, you know, when we saw the huge turnout for the Veronica Mars just in the first day, it was millions of dollars already. You know, obviously they are. They're benefited certainly by their fame, and I, you know, one or two things here and there is fine, but you know, the minute that that Veronica Mars' thing went big, you know, a week later, the actress Melissa Joan Hart had one trying to raise $2 million. She failed pretty significantly. So I guess at least there is some, you know, sort of natural selection going on. But you know, and then Zach Braff jumped on it, and then James Franco had an Indiegogo campaign. You know, I just worry that it's going to get more and more and more, and all of a sudden it's going to be kind of de rigueur to pay $100 but to see a movie that's not even been made yet.
Hmm. Well, one last question, as we've got about less than a minute to go here. You know, there's only so much money to go around. If we keep seeing these big celebrity projects, will the bottom just fall out at some point?
Well, I'd worry that the smaller stuff will completely disappear, and then you know, and it'll just be these massive kind of top tier things.
Well, we'll be keeping an eye on it, and I'm betting you're going to keep writing about it.
I think so. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Richard.
Thanks so much for having me.
Richard Lawson is a senior writer at the Atlantic Wire, and you'll find links to some of his pieces on the Central Time Facebook page. And let us know what you think. Should the rich and famous get to hold out their hats on Kickstarter? What have you chosen to fund or not to fund there? Let us know on Facebook.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll get to know the ins and outs of a Scandinavian lawn game called Kub. It's a passion of Central Time producer Chris Molina's, and he'll give us a primer on the game as we get ready for the National Kub Tournament. That's coming up this weekend.
And we'll talk with the author of The End of Night, who says deep natural darkness is getting harder and harder to find in the era of light pollution run amok.
Also, we'll take a look at the obsessive nature of some of the world's top achievers.
Tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to an author who says we've bred the nutrients out of our food by making it more sugary and more starchy. I'm Veronica Rickert.
I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell, in for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. According to our next guest, ever since we invented agriculture 10,000 years ago, we've been choosing fruits and vegetables that are high in sugar and starch and low in vitamins, minerals, fiber, and antioxidants.
Now, as a result, there is a big difference between the nutrients in the wild plants of our original diet and the man-made versions that we eat today. We'll be taking your calls during this segment, so give us a ring at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our guest is health writer and food activist Jo Robinson. Her book is called Eating on the Wild Side. Jo, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
It's hard to imagine what food was like, you know, before agriculture, but you start out with a pretty good example of it early in the book in the introduction when you talk about, you kind of give us a thumbnail sketch of the banana, and I'm wondering if you could do that for our listeners.
Yes, our white, easy-to-peel, seedless banana started out as basically a seed case for this big, bushy plant. And it was chock full of seeds that were probably about a quarter inch in diameter, and it was the banana was very starchy without any, you know, obvious sweetness, and the peels did not zip off. You had to get a machete to pry them loose. And it's very likely that people didn't eat them in that form until they found a mutant form. And this happened to be one of nature's mutants, which happens all the time. This was a major mutation that actually would have been the end of the banana if it wasn't for some clever person who walked by this bush, picked one of these bananas, and saw that the seeds had been downsized to the mere dots. I mean, they were gone, basically, which made it a lot better to eat. And also, now that it didn't have seeds that you could plant, this person realized that he or she had to clone this plant, and that's how we got the banana we have today. And it's also the one we chose is white, and there's 400 varieties of bananas being eaten around the world, and many of them are much higher in beta carotene. One has 400 times more beta carotene. So the one we have now is seedless, zip-off peel, high in sugar, and very low in beta-carotene.
And big on convenience and low on price, you know, those things that really matter to people.
Yes, yes. And people love bananas.
I confess I love bananas.
Yeah, it's a great comfort food.
Now, one of the other things, too, you point out early in the book, too, because there is this trend towards heirloom foods of one kind or another right now, heirloom tomatoes, apples, that sort of thing. Older isn't always necessarily better. I was a little startled by that. You said, you know, the apple that your great-grandfather may have eaten may not be as good as the apple you're eating now. So going back isn't always better in some cases.
Well, it depends how far you go back.
Ah, okay.
And if we're going back, let's say, to our grandparents or our great-grandparents, we've been farmers for 400 generations. And so we've only gone back three or four generations for these heirlooms that we're eating, and we've been making changes for 10,000 years. So what our great-grandparents ate was also much lower in nutrients than wild plants. So I'm saying we go way back, not to eating wild plants themselves, because we wouldn't like the way they tasted. We wouldn't do it. But to modern varieties that have many of the nutrients of wild plants, but have that flavor that we've come to love and expect.
Yeah,
that's,
so let's go. Let's go back to some of those very early smart people who figured out that they could manipulate plants to taste the way they liked. What is it about breeding fruits and vegetables to be higher in starch and sugar that really appeals to a human being?
It speaks to our the whole sensory apparatus, our taste buds, and the way those taste buds are linked to our brain. And we are programmed now, as we were, you know, 100,000 years ago, to really like sweet starch, fat, and sugar. Why? Because these things were really scarce in the wilderness. And we needed a lot of calories. We needed energy-dense food. So we were hardwired to really like to eat foods that were the sweetest, the least fibrous, the highest in oil, the, you know, the most succulent. And that's what we did. And it works okay in the wilderness, but, you know, you take that same wiring and you put it in a modern supermarket, and we're picking the wrong, you know, foods that are not advantageous for our health.
And so there is a trade-off there, and a trade-off we don't always understand, because our bodies, our senses, I guess, still tell us somewhere deep in the recesses that this is what we ought to be eating, this that there, we need that sugar to survive.
That's right. These MRA scans of the brain show when the pleasure centers, there's about 11 pleasure centers, are really active, and they, on these scans, they show up in bright colors. And when we think of sweet food or a dessert or eat it, it's like fireworks in our brain. It gives us all of these areas are dumping dopamine and other important neurotransmitters into our system and saying, you want to eat more of this. And that happens today. Even though we're, you know, we have things that are 40, 50% sugar, and the brain is still saying yes.
And food manufacturers today know that, right? I mean, and so why aren't they more responsible, or are they just simply responding to us?
Well, it's the short-term, you know, economic bottom line that drives them, and they know full well exactly. They know so well what it is that we want to eat more of. They have taste panels and really elaborate studies that have gone on for decades. They know what gets our neurotransmitters flowing, and that's what they're feeding us, and that's what we want to eat more and more of. So it's a bit diabolical, especially now as we know more and more about what that food is missing and how it is, can have really negative effects on our health in terms of obesity and diabetes, cancer, cardiovascular disease, Alzheimer's. Our, you know, our low nutrient, high sugar food is really giving us more chronic health problems than ever before.
And let's talk about what you say is missing from our modern diet. And one of the things, you talk about two things, but flavor is one, but nutrients are the other. So if we look back at, say, some of that, I don't know if to call it old food, but original food before everybody figured out that they wanted sweets and sugars and starches and so forth, those nutrients, are they different than the nutrients that we see now that winds up in our food? And if so, how?
They're not different, but we have many fewer of them, in particular these compounds called polyphenols, which I use a friendlier term, phytonutrients. And these are compounds that all plants produce as a way to defend themselves against external threats like insects and browsers and UV light and drought and floods. And they're constantly producing them to defend themselves. And now we know, and I'm talking about the last 15, 20 years, that when we eat food that are rich in these phytonutrients, we absorb them to differing degrees, And we're protected from our own threats, and that's those diseases, you know, the chronic inflammation and diabetes. But we have bred out these phytonutrients to such an extent that in some cases we only have, in terms of apples, maybe 1/100th, 1% of the phytonutrients that are found in wild apples. And they also, it's not just a numbers game, because researchers have found that wild crab apples are 80 times more effective at killing cancer cells than the Fuji apple in our supermarket. So this is really new information that has profound implications for our health.
400 generations, though, of farming, does this mean that all of these original wild fruits and vegetables are gone, or can we still find remnants of them, or can we find the real thing someplace?
Yeah, we can find the real thing. They're not extinct. We just don't eat them anymore. You know, we've left them for the insects and the bears and the, the other animals. No, they're right there. And so researchers around the world have been comparing wild plants with their food, the food that they eat, and now there's thousands of studies showing this dramatic difference.
We're speaking with Joe Robinson, the author of Eating on the Wild Side, and I will be checking the headlines and back with your calls. Do you have any questions for Joe about the food that you eat? And what produce do you look for high levels of nutrients? And more importantly, where do you find it? Give us a call. We'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Or drop us an email, talk@WPR.org.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
I'm Gene Purcell. We're back with Joe Robinson, the author of Eating on the Wild Side, and we'd like to hear from you, too, your questions and thoughts on which produce is the most nutritious that you like and where you can find it. Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can also post on our Central Time Facebook page. We've got some calls lined up already, and let's go to Juliana, who joins us from Wausau. Good afternoon.
Hello there. I just want to say congratulations to Joe for producing this book, because I think it's a really important aspect of nutrition for us to look at. And I have been eating wild food for a long time, and it's really not that difficult once you get into the habit. You know, the thing that is true for most of us is that we've just got used to that food comes off the grocery store shelf and it's better for you. And then when you get to really studying about it and finding out, as she points out, that it is definitely not as nutritious, the wild stuff is out there and it's free.
Juliana, thanks so much for the call. Joe Robinson. Juliana brings up a good point, but, you know, there is a big step there, because it is so easy just to take that food off the shelf and take it home. And if you don't know what you're doing, it is so difficult to know what to look for. So where do people start if they're interested in trying to, you know, find wild produce, to eat well, to do some of the things that you're talking about?
My book isn't about foraging in the wild. There's some excellent books on that, and I enjoy doing that myself. But I've written it for people who are going to forage in the supermarket and in the farmer's market. And another of the important discoveries in the last 20 or so years has been that there's a really wide range of health benefits among the varieties of the same fruit or vegetable. Let me give you an example about tomatoes. Many people know that the phytonutrient in tomatoes that is so beneficial for the cardiovascular system is called lycopene. Well, on that one counter in the supermarket where all the tomatoes are, if you were to pick a cherry tomato, smaller, darker red, the better, you're going to get 20 times more lycopene than if you were to get a big beefsteak. So in tomatoes, you want to look for small and dark red. And so, you know, these small dark red ones are almost as nutritious as wild ones, but they're really delicious. They're sweet. They're sweeter than the big ones, and they have a really intense flavor. So that's just a simple way we can start bringing back wild nutrients, is knowing which ones to pick in the grocery store.
And one of the big things, kind of a surprise in your book, you say the most nutritious tomatoes in the supermarket are not in the produce section. They're in the canned goods aisle.
Yes. Now, these food scientists are turning everything upside down.
Yeah.
what they've discovered, that tomatoes are better for us the longer they're cooked. And so the most nutritious in the best form of lycopene is actually canned tomato paste, for a couple of reasons. One, because it's so concentrated, but the heat increases the lycopene in it. And also, when they make canned tomatoes, they take fully ripened ones that have as much phytonutrients as they're ever going to have. And the ones in our store are picked, the fresh ones are picked green, and then often hastened to an orange-red color with ethylene gas. And they're just never going to have the phytonutrients they could have. So, yes, I was surprised to learn that this can of tomato paste is one of the most nutritious things in the store.
Let's go to Richard now, and Richard joins us from Neenah. Hi.
Hi. I have wild strawberries in my backyard, and occasionally I've tasted some, and they're pretty much like cardboard. But I've also gone picking wild mulberries. In fact, they're in season right now in my area. They're absolutely delicious and sweet and taste like something you'd get in the grocery store with, like you're describing, the overbred ones. Why is it that in the wild some of these fruits and vegetables are so sweet and delicious and others are not?
It has to do with the different chemical composition. There's many of the phytonutrients that are the most potent have a slightly bitter, sour, or astringent taste. And so that means some of the most beneficial foods are not as sweet and mild as others. But sometimes it's very sweet food that's highest in nutrients, because it means it's, especially in terms of fruit, it's a very perfectly ripened fruit. And, these fruits they capture these sugars partly because they're trying to attract animals and people to eat them and carry the seeds away. So I love it when I can find a fruit or vegetable that is very sweet, that is extra good for you. And a good example is white peaches and nectarines. You would have to eat 6 yellow-fleshed peaches or nectarines to get the same phytonutrient content as you would from 1 white fleshed peach or nectarine. So it's like, here's an example of something that, and these are sweeter. These white ones are sweeter. Of something that's very sweet, that's better for you than something that is more colorful and less sweet.
All right, thanks so much for the call. Let's head to Milwaukee right now, and Matt is with us. Or Matt may not be with us. So let's head back to our guest right now and talk a little bit about the way we prepare food, because that is a big part of your book as well. And one of the things you tell us is that the way you prepare food actually can affect the nutrients you get out of it. And could you talk about that and maybe give us a good example?
More just excellent information is coming out of these food labs. The new focus is, how can we enhance and protect these phytonutrients that we now are discovering are so important for us? And this is something that's never been studied in home economics. It was always, vitamin C and beta-carotene, and in particular the heat-sensitive nutrients. That's what we've been taught, how to prepare things to maintain those particular nutrients, but these phytonutrients is a whole new ballgame. Sometimes, here's something that was discovered in 2007 that I think everybody should know. We've all known that garlic is good for us. People have known this for thousands of years. In Egypt, garlic was, someone made a list of 23 recipes of how to use garlic for health, so we've known this forever. But only in the last 6 or 7 years have we known that if you're going to cook with garlic, you need to chop it, press it, cut it, whatever you want to do with it, and set it aside for 10 minutes before you put it in hot oil or any hot food if you want the health benefits. So that's an example of a brand new understanding, which could have a positive effect on our health. Garlic has incredible anti-cancer properties, but we're not going to have that unless we do the chop, press, and rest 10 minutes before we put it in the hot oil or food. At that point, it can take all the heat you want to give it, and it is still going to have all of this allicin, which is, the medicinal component.
And so where is all this research being done? I mean, the garlic thing, 2007, it seems like something we should have known a long time ago.
Well, that's my job, and it's really, it's alarming, really, how many things that I've found that have been in academic tests, texts, and have not been released to the public. Every day, I can find a nugget of information that people should know that no one has bothered to communicate to the public. So I go in there, I find these nuggets, and then I write about them in ways that people can understand and take immediate advantage of. I love doing that.
That's interesting. Let's try Matt again, and I think Matt is still with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Matt.
Yeah, hi. Thanks. Sorry about that. I got disconnected before. Thank you, Joe, for your information. I haven't read the book, but I'll pick it up. My question is, it is a two-part question, but I've been told not to ask the second question, but I'm going to do that anyways. So first, if there's all this research and it's out there and we all know it exists and it points to the logical conclusion that real food is better food, you know, what does it take in terms of government stepping in or big business being okay with leaner margins? You know, what will it take to shift the dynamic for what seems to be a pretty common sense thing? And the follow-up, which is related, is the Institute of Integrative Nutrition seems to be, you know, training this massive sales force of health coaches. And I've had the benefit of listening to a lot of those lectures and just the information, you're right, is just endless. So are they going to take more of a lobbyist stance? Are they going to try to use their scale for good? Or are they just another, profit machine?
Yeah, your two questions are really can be, you know, it's really all of one piece. The information in my book, it's a little bit scary in a way, but I'm the first person to aggregate it all. So we can't, at this point in time, we can't fault big industry, food manufacturers, industrial agriculture, for not retaining these phytonutrients. The information is too new. The reason I'm the first aggregator is because this information was spread out over thousands of studies published in dozens of countries, and it took me 10 years to identify it and pull it all together. So this is such new information that we can't expect industry to even move on it if they wanted to. But I'm kind of throwing out the gauntlet. I'm saying, okay, now this is known. Now this is out there. So how are you going to respond to it? And I have some suggestions. One is the USDA, which is using our tax dollars, I believe that every time they're developing a new fruit or vegetable, that they should be testing all of their experimental varieties for nutritional value and including that nutritional content in their decision about which ones to select. It's amazing how the nutritional content of the food takes a back seat to how long it can be stored on the shelf.
And I'm afraid, Joe, that we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, you're welcome. It's been fun.
Joe Robinson, health writer, food activist, and author of Eating on the Wild Side.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.